Welcome to Geared for Growth. I'm your host, Mike Mortlock, Managing Director of MCG Quantity Surveyors. Today, we've got a bit of an investor story, one of the types of episodes that I did a couple of years ago, which was a little bit more of a longer format, but we've managed to crunch this down to 30-odd minutes. We're hearing the story about Richard Barata, who is a Chinese-Indonesian that came to Perth in his early teen years and developed some great habits around saving money, but then also some terrible habits about spending money. And he's very generous in sharing his journey around money and, of course, his fantastic journey, such as it is today, which is him purchasing 10 properties in 3 years. We ask him how on earth he achieved that, what he looks for in the properties, and how he came across the hurdles that investors have with funding portfolios as they grow. It's an awesome interview with Richard, who's now thankfully helping other people with his buyer's agency business to do the same. I'm sure you'll get a lot out of this one. Here's Richard. Richard Barata, thanks for joining me on Geared for Growth.
No, thanks for having me, Mike.
Now, I will almost certainly have, after this recording, recorded an intro, which gives a little bit of a spoiler alert to the success that you've achieved in property investing. But could you take us back to your upbringing? Before you even thought about investing in property, your upbringing, I think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you might say that it kind of defined who you were as an adult.
Yes, and it becomes, I guess, my, in a sense, the value that my parents taught me becomes, in a sense, a saver in my downfall down the track, which I will be more than happy to share in this little short. And yeah, so basically, long story short, grew up in Indonesia, came to Perth in Australia when I was 12, lived with my uncle, with my brothers, since then, so that makes me a bit independent as a person. You know, always hungry at school because no one brought me lunch. So, but anyway, so growing up, I'm always a very hard working person. I always want to do well, but sometimes I do become lazy, you know, once I feel like I'm doing well. And I guess one thing I know that my mom especially always teaches me is saving. And that's just how she grew up. She's a family of, I think, eight. You know, she's got seven or eight siblings. And you know, growing up wasn't easy for mom, right? Mm-hmm. So that's growing up, we always been taught of how to save and, not to recklessly spend money.
Yes. And what was the motivation behind moving from Indonesia to Perth? And that must have been quite a culture shock.
Oh, it's really, Australia is a land of opportunity as you know it, right? So, and this brings in a quite interesting story, which I've shared in some other podcasts. So basically in the 90s, there were this political war in Indonesia and a lot of Chinese Indonesian, like myself, we sort of become the black goat, a scapegoat. Yep. I think it's okay if I share it here. It's a public secret. There were a lot of corruptions back then. And then the Chinese business people got the blame of it. And then what happened is there's a lot of riots and killings, raping, like really massive crazy stuff happening over there. So a lot of Indonesians and Chinese Indonesians in particular, they fly away to America, to other countries that are more safe in a sense. Yeah, right. Yeah. So what happened in the 90s, my mom bought a piece of land in Perth, in a suburb called Joondalup. This is in the 90s, right? To enable us, the kids, to get permanent residency back then, right? So that drove the motivation back then. But finally, I'll just put it in here. My dad, at the same time, he bought a BMW back then, about the same price.
Right.
So, and you know what happened with each one of those. The land now has got a house on top of it, and it's probably close to $750,000 now, whereas the BMW is just sitting on our backyard doing nothing.
Unless it's a very, very, very rare car, it's not going to outperform real estate. So it's funny you said your mother taught you to save, and the evidence of that was she bought a block of land and your father bought a BMW. So he wasn't obviously the saving influence.
No.
So I want to sort of fast forward to the point where you had these virtues instilled in you, working hard and saving, to developing some poor spending habits. When did you get to the point where you had money coming in that you were actually had an ability to make poor spending decisions?
So it's just I just see this as a pattern, and I'm trying to get better as I mature. Even now, like, I always have the tendency to do really well, you know, always give my best. And then I hit that point of complacency, I think, and then you start downfalling. And that sort of pattern gets repeated throughout my primary school into high school. So like primary school, I was doing well. And then year 7, year 8, I was doing really bad. And then I sort of repented. I did really well towards the end of high school, got scholarship into uni. And I got complacent, and I did really poorly in the first 3 years of uni, and then did really, really well in the last year of uni. And then where it got into the bad spending habit is where I thought I was doing really well in my career, in my engineering career. And I was earning quite decent in a sense. I was very grateful for what I was earning. But because I didn't know podcasts like this or similar, no one really taught me how to invest those money. So I'm getting all these extra savings just sitting on the bank, and I thought, I'm pretty rich here. What do I do with this money? Yeah, and that leads to a pretty poor spending habit.
Yeah, because I'm guessing, as distinct from, say, your mother growing up in a big family, there was never an excess of money. So there was never an opportunity to blow it, I suppose. But you were in this, you know, new kind of generation where you did well at uni eventually after you applied yourself, and you earned some good money, but you actually had excess. It wasn't about, you know, saving because, you know, you didn't have a lot of capital coming in. You actually had a good bit of cash flow. But this is, I suppose, a cautionary tale for the listeners that if you do get a pay rise or you get a bit of a windfall, you need to think about ways to be using that money in a positive way, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that is really something I sort of preach, not only to my clients, but also to friends and family. You know, when you earn more, don't just think you're earning an extra 10 grand, because if you can make those 10 grand into an asset that's 5 times, 10 times those 10 grand, you know, then, you know, you are in a good run for like this compounding madness. Mm.
Yeah. And when it came to the point of you thinking, okay, well, Richard, you're doing your normal pattern, you're stuffing around and then getting forced to do really well, you've done the stuffing around with the money, we need to get serious. At what point did you start thinking, I need to do something with this money, and when did that become property?
Yeah, so maybe I'll just one step back, Mike. So just for everyone that is listening, the poor spending habit that I did is, for lack of better words, probably gaming addiction. So basically, this is before all the investing started. We went to nice holidays, you know, going to the snow, which I really love. That's where we plan to retire. But those are really good experience you are creating with your, I guess, friends and family, right? Yeah. But what I meant by poor spending habit, that's close to $50,000 on something that really brings nothing. It's a mobile gaming app that initially free. They always make it free, and then that gives you a little sugar hit with $5, and then a bigger sugar hit for $10, $100, until $1,000, $2,000 a month. I'm talking about $2,000, $3,000 a month, right? And it brings nothing, really, right? So it's different if you're going on holidays. You have those memory forever. So I guess to me, why am I sharing this is because it can be anything. It can be smoking, it can be drugs, or it can be, I don't know, anything, you name it, right? But I think there's always, if you really know, there's a better way, which where I get into property, I think you can see the lights, you know, at the end of the tunnel. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, thank you for sharing that, Richard, because I'm sure there are times where you kind of wish you didn't have that on your resume to some degree. And I suppose I skipped over it because I wasn't sure if that's something that you wanted to disclose. But I mean, these things, not dissimilar to many other things in society, they're designed by very, very clever people, often by psychologists, to give you that sugar hit in such a way that it makes you want to come back for more. So I think it's easy for people that, you know, haven't been involved in gaming or in the mobile apps to go like, why would you do that? But it's not like you're sitting there going, should I spend $3,000 on whatever it gives me? It's starting with that $5 thing because I've invested so much time and it's like, oh, I could actually get to the next level. And walls close in around you and you're like, well, the next level is success, you know, so why wouldn't I spend it, you know?
That's right. Sorry, just to cut you as well. Even for designer back, I know the like very expensive designer bags, they create this little ecosystem where if you want those top tier product, which everyone wants, you have to spend on the smaller things.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
And then sunglasses and stuff.
Yeah, it's like they create this little ecosystem. You got to spend $5,000, $10,000, $40,000, $50,000 until you get offered this really nice bag, which then you can obviously, that's even better than this gaming addiction because once you buy that bag, you can actually resell it for like double the price because how rare they make it to be, right? So, but anyway, you're right. So
yeah, but I guess there's no shortage of things trying to take your money away from you, and very few of them are going to be appreciating assets. I don't think even yourself would argue that you should be investing in designer handbags, right? So you obviously came to that realization, that Rubicon moment, and what was it about property that spoke to you to begin with?
Yeah, so where it all started really when a friend of mine introduced me to shares. So that was throughout COVID, right? So I never knew about shares. I guess being engineer, I always know what compounding means on the paper, but never really anyone taught me about the applicability of that and how that can actually create financial freedom or financial healthiness throughout your life. So my friend was sharing about shares, and naturally I got really into it, and I started doing my own research, watch YouTube, listening to podcasts, all this while I sort of exited those gaming addiction and started to save for my first home, right? So, and because of that addiction, we sort of delayed our purchase for our home.
Right.
So we were saving, and then you know, when you research about shares or anything investment, you get hit by all those algorithms with investment, property investment, anything, Bitcoins, you know, you just get hit by that, right? And then I came across a YouTuber called Graham Stephan. He's based in the United States, but he talks about how he was talking about shares, right? But all the diversification, showing the pie chart. But then there was one line he was telling me, well, not telling me, telling people, shares is good, but his favorite investment is still property, right? And then I started to compare the two. I didn't understand the concept of leverage back then, because what I knew was with property, you have all this maintenance, you have all this tax here and there. But when you compare it side by side, it seems the property is giving you a better return in the long run. Yeah. And then he also shared the blueprint of creating a property portfolio, which is you buy one, if you buy well, grows in value, you can liquefy the sum of the equity, and then you just replicate that strategy into another property, and then the third one, the fourth one, the fifth one. So that's where I really wanted to know about property investing. Yeah. But it took me almost a year to really start taking the first action.
And from that action, and I talked about a spoiler alert, you actually went to the point where you purchased 10 properties in 3 years. Now that, I don't even think there's a book that's called 10 properties in 3 years. There's always like 30 properties before 30 or 10 in 10, but not 10 in three. So perhaps there's a new market there for you. But look, I sort of say to people that those metrics are not necessarily important, but What is certainly obvious is that you did decide to take action in a big, big way. So what was the first one, and how did you get that momentum to be able to go so fast, so quick? Was it sort of 2 in 2 years and then the rest after that, or break it down for us?
Yeah, I think the first one is our principal place of residence in bloody Sydney, and costed us $1.2 million, right? And for a small house, really, but we loved it, and we did it for lifestyle, right? And we bought that in early 2021, and that was, we bought that not with the investor hat. We bought that for lifestyle purpose, because we were planning to, my wife and I, we were planning to have to start a family. And traditional thinking, you always want to have your place of residence first for security, right? Not always the case. We just got a little bit lucky because we bought it in early 2021. You know, sort of not even halfway through the madness when Sydney was having that COVID boom, right? So we overpaid, but it still grew okay, right? So for the last 3 years. And we are still paying 2% interest. So for those wondering, how is this guy servicing all this loan until next year? So I'm still paying 2% on that. But I do realize throughout that year, 2021, a similar property is selling easily within 6, 7, 8 months, 1.3, 1.4, 1.5, until something that's sort of comparable we're selling 1.7, which is really blew my mind. And that's when I realized, hang on a second, like, did I just get a few hundred grand richer here just by buying this home accidentally?
Yeah.
Which is the case, because you can always draw down that equity, right? So that's when I realized this compounding thing is real, and it's not just growing like 7% a year. It's actually growing at the right time. It's growing like 20-30% in a single year, right? So I was sort of contemplating between that idea of buying our investment property. I always have that in mind. For me, it's pretty simple. If you buy the right asset that grows in value and you have access to funding, you combine the two, then you can have a journey, basically, right? Mm-hmm. And what we did was, and then we bought our first investment property, early 2022. Yeah. Can you hear me? Hello?
I lost you there for a second, Richard.
I'm sorry. Oh, that's okay.
Yeah, so you basically just finished a bit talking about the first property. So if you want to maybe jump into, how you went to the second one.
Yeah, the second investment or the second property?
The second property, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, basically we bought our first investment property in early 2022 in Perth back then. We started educating ourselves, buying well, and then we sort of just rolled on with it. And because I was actually self-employed back then, so it was really hard to get finance back then.
What you had in spades was a fair amount of luck. Sydney 2021, Perth 2022, I think 2020 2 and 23 for Perth, the growth numbers were amazing. I want to question you on that, though, because I know that there will be people thinking, okay, well, he might have been self-employed and the banks are going to give him a few more headaches, but he's an engineer, he's bought him, his first property is $1 million in Sydney, that's gone up, he's jagged Perth. Now that might be a bit unfair. You might have done a tremendous amount of research and you deserve all the success that you got. But what would you say to the people that are just like, well, that's really what made the difference for you?
I think it all by taking action, right? So, I sort of told you, we sort of delayed our purchase in Sydney in 2021, right? And it's because I stuffed up our deposit, because we didn't have too much deposit when we started. We could have bought during at the bottom of 2020 when COVID was hitting rock bottom. We would probably pay $300K cheaper back then, right? But I think that's a hindsight, and from then on, I sort of look at myself, look, let's look forward and see what we can do, right? So we know that property can make you wealthy, right? And now how do we get there? How do we replicate this strategy? So we bought the first investment property in early 2022. Everyone were paying 2% interest rates back then, yep. Because rate hasn't gone up. I was paying 4.5% back then, because I have to go through the low doc lending pathway. But if I didn't take that risk, I wouldn't be able to grab that 4x2 in Perth for less than 400K, which is impossible nowadays, isn't it?
So, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I was playing the devil's advocate there, which felt a little bit mean. I apologize. But I think you're right that the big ingredient in the success is, yes, okay, there might have been some luck with the interest rate on the first one or Sydney or Perth or what have you, but you've got to be in it to win it, right? You have to make those decisions to put yourself in a place where those things can happen.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
And so from there, obviously we know the end story is 10 properties in 3 years. Was there a point where you hit some troubles, like a serviceability ceiling, or the banks were giving you trouble, or was it a dream run all the way to double digits?
Yeah, look, I think since then we never really did a really, in my opinion, a really poor investment decision. All of the properties we bought has grown at least 100K, even the one we bought in 2023. So how I did it was obviously surround myself with people who are also investing, mm-hmm. right? People who are more advanced, or people who even just started. Sometimes they have the brightest ideas, you know. But we all know we are looking at the same goal and using the same vehicle, which is properties, right? Mm. I got inspired by someone who went like 7 properties in like 6 months, right? And he's not making it public like what I'm doing now, but I got really, really inspired by that person. And then I was talking to him, how did you do it? And then, you know, you get all this connection with the bankers, with people from banks, and all the tips and tricks. So, and when you sort of surround yourself with people like that, you know, you're not doing the wrong thing, because there are like 20 other people doing the same thing, right? And they're doing really well. And so we bought the second one basically in April, just around 400K, mid 400K. And then after April, when we hit July, that's when, 1st of July, we did all our tax, you know, so we can get that financials on paper, so we can open up our serviceability. Yeah, so we went the second one in April, and then we won the third one again in Perth. I think that was July 2022. And then another one in December 2022. Yep. And what I want to share as well is having the right mortgage broker. In my instance, when I was trying to buy that, I guess, fourth investment property, a lot of brokers were saying no. All the banks were saying no to me, right? But I was hanging out digitally on property chat forum, yep. being a keyboard warrior and talk to people. And then I met this person who actually now become my broker, who opened up that way to the fourth investment property. And he's been buying for my 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th. 9th, 10th now. So
without sort of giving away his secret sauce, what was it that he saw that could be done to help get you through that serviceability buffer? Because there might not the serviceability buffer, a barrier. There might be some people that are listening that are kind of stuck at that second or that third one. Is it a matter of having access to other lenders? Is it more about how to structure them from a structure point of view? What are some of the ways that he's enabled you to push through?
So there's actually quite a lot, Mike. So one of them is going to the tier three lender. Obviously, you're paying a very high interest rates with all the nasty costs, and some other secret sauce that I probably don't want to spill it here, because it's not his secret. Yeah, I know some other brokers are doing the same thing. When we got the fourth one, that's what he did. But when we bought the fifth investment in 2023, early 2023, we started going to tier three lender. And this is when I was starting to operate as a buyer's agent, and I was looking for all these deals and then look for something that no one wanted because you don't have many clients when you started.
Yep.
And then we thought, no matter how I look at this from all different angles, it looks like a pretty good deal. So I spoke to him, gave me the assurance, yeah, just do it if it's good. And then, yeah, and then we went with LaTrobe, which is pretty high interest rates back then. Yep. So, and then obviously after that I bought that on the 3rd of, in March 2023.
Yep.
And then the next one was July, which is after that financial year.
Yeah. And so my maths is not as good as an engineer's. Where are we up to now? What property number was that?
So that was fifth investment. So you call it sixth property, yeah.
And so you've managed to purchase the last four in a very short period of time. Is it a point, is the point sort of like getting the first one is harder than the fifth, sixth, seventh sort of thing? You got that momentum by purchasing properties in growth locations. So, you know, like you said, the property's at least going up 100K. Is that where you really started to see the power of your rolling sort of snowball?
Yeah, I think so. And then you get better with every purchase. Every purchase is a bigger challenge now because you keep telling yourself, oh, I want to get a better deal than the last time or a different X factor, right? So when I bought my first one, second, third, you know, you make all those little mistakes, not critical, but things like overpaying for one of my properties in Cairns. I overpaid about 10 grand. It's not like killing you or anything.
Yeah.
But, and then other things like, you didn't know the agent was phishing you for a higher price. Like now you know exactly if they're trying to do that. So it becomes an easier to buy, like very easy. And that's why we're buying for other people as well. Yeah.
Sorry, Richard.
There you go.
I was just about to ask what made you want to help other people to make the financial decisions such as you have and work on their financial future? What made you want to start the buyer's agency business?
I guess, yeah, it's like if I put a really stupid analogy, you know, if you just eat a really nice pizza or Chinese food and it's like the best taste ever and it's healthy and it's good for your health, which is obviously not the case with pizzas and Chinese food.
Yeah.
Natural tendency, you want to share those good news with people, right? Or at least people you care about to begin with. So I did do that. I did start sharing with my parents, with my brothers, with my friends. And then with the people in my property community, right? And then there were a few people who actually struggled to buy, and they sort of offered me cash, basically money, if I can find them a good property, right? And that's when I see there's a market for it, and it is something I always do anyway as a hobby and as a passion, finding properties, good properties, and I feel like it's like all the stars are aligning, like, why not do it? Mm-hmm. Why not do it, right? And as long as you can earn decent enough to put food on your table, then and you're actually making a really good impact in someone's life in this way, right? And it's not like when I was doing engineering stuff, right? I was basically one person, a small tadpole in the big ocean. You know, what I'm doing is only a small part of it, whereas now it's more impactful to people's life.
Yeah, so. I think that is the best reason to start a business. So congratulations on that. To finish us off, Richard, I'd love to know, with your engineering brain and obviously the properties that you've purchased, which you can't argue have been successful, they've all gone up in value. What do you look for in a property? I mean, given that you are, you know, having to finance with second or third tier lenders. Obviously, even they have requirements. So is it very yield heavy, but you have to have the growth as well? You know, are we talking houses, units? Are we talking multi-dwelling sites? What stands out to you as a Richard Barata blue chip investment grade property? Not blue chip, but investment grade.
Yeah, but for me, I think everyone obviously has different appetite. A first-time buyer probably like something newer, less maintenance, looks a little bit beautiful on the photo, which not necessarily always make the best numbers on the papers, right? But for me, really, it has to be have a strong yield. It doesn't have to have a mining town kind of yield, you know, 9-10%, but at least 5%. You know, like if you can achieve 5% plus, that's pretty decent. So at times like now, when money is a bit not cheap, a bit expensive, it doesn't really put you under the water. But that's secondary. To be honest, the most important thing really is the growth itself, right? Because that's where actually wealth is created, through the growth, right? Not through the cash flow. The cash flow is more like for when you know, retire all your debt and, you know, enjoy all the passive income there. But because I call myself sort of still in my accumulation phase, I always keep looking for those growth assets, which doesn't hurt my pocket too much.
Yeah, of course. And when it comes to growth, and this is a big question that's probably another episode, but is there any sort of standout metric that you look at to go, this is a location that, that meets my criteria for growth?
Yeah, I think the thing I like about property is it's quite predictable in the way the direction is going, right? I guess, you know, very standard metrics is like based on market, stock on market, and just calling agents, speaking to locals. When you know there's a property that has 10 offers, you know, and they're pretty high offers as well, you know the next property in that nearby area is going to sell higher or around the same. And you know, when the property is gone within 2-3 days, there's no other way. That property has to go up in value, in price. But at the same time, you don't want to overpay for something. We're talking about Perth here, where it's really almost impossible. It's just very challenging there with no stocks. So I guess metrics wise, there's all those standard metrics, but for me it's really to minimize competition and try to buy at the lower end of that price range.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Richard, that's given me a lot to think about, and I'm sure that everyone listening has learnt, and you should be congratulated for your success. Because as I mentioned before, you've got to be in it to win it, and you've done a great job so far. So thank you very much for sharing all of that wisdom with us today.
No, thank you, Mike. Thank you. Really nice chatting to you.
Likewise. Thanks, Richard. Yeah.